Hello and welcome back to another episode of Only a Notebook. I am your host, Nathaniel Mellor, and I thought today's a good day to make some grammatical enemies and talking about a couple of rules of writing that relate to a sort of a larger whole. And I'll be more specific, I guess, later, but I thought it's a good intro. I think like a lot of you probably have, you know, had someone in your life, whether it be a teacher or a parent or a friend who's, you know, very strict grammarian, somebody who's very quick to correct you if you mispronounce a word or if you use the wrong word, or if, I mean, further versus farther or fewer versus less or something like that, continual versus continuous. My dad was a lot like that. You know, he was this very, he's like, you got to be very specific with how you write or how you talk. You know, there is one form of English. Well, there's many forms of English, but you know, he's like, you gotta speak it properly. And I think that's, you know, fine, I guess. But I realize when it comes to writing, it's something I notice a lot. When I do beta read people's books, when I do edit, and I realize that a lot of people have different, obviously, not necessarily different ways. Some people do have, you know, they use incorrect usage of words, farther versus further, things like that. But there's a couple of these other rules, such as don't end a sentence with a preposition or don't split an infinitive. That, you know, it's these sort of things that some editors will be like, I'll look out for those and I'll make sure that I catch them. And I think for me, it's a sort of, it's not that it doesn't matter. It's not that I won't, you know, explain them to the person, but I get very curious about this for a couple of reasons. But I get very curious because it is, you know, questions like, I think we often forget that, you know, language is just simply used to communicate. It's simply used to express a point, a point of view or perspective. Maybe it's used to convey information. And I think we sometimes forget that in that sort of like, well, I you know, if it's not going to be proper, then you might as well just not say anything. And when I went to France a couple of years ago, people had warned me, you know, they said, when you go to Paris and you might try to speak French, you might try to order a coffee or, you know, croissant, in French, and you might get people who, you know, basically will sort of ignore you if you are not speaking, as properly as possible, or if your accent is not as perfect as possible. And I think that's obviously a gross generalization, of an entire, you know, people who live in an entire city. But when I actually went, I did realize there were a couple of times when I'd order a croissant, a croissant, or a pain au chocolat or something like that. And, you know, I try a few different variations of the pronunciation, but I'm still, you know, and then they still wouldn't get it. And I'm like pointing and I'm like, what am I missing here? Like, I came into a pastry shop and I'm asking for croissant and I'm pointing at the croissant and I don't know if there's something else I should be doing because you're not asking me a question in return. You're not saying something like, would you like it warmed up or would you like it, I don't know, sliced or something? I don't know. So it's very strange. So I remember thinking like, this is really interesting. It's sort of like either it's done on purpose or there's something, you know, there is a, again, my grasp of French is incredibly limited. So I didn't know if there's another word that is very similar, you know, to croissant. That they were like, you know, is he saying, what is he saying? And I worked for a couple of years as a cashier at a, you know, very small grocery store. And we often had people from foreigners, people from out of the country, out of town. But because we're in a tourist town, we had a lot of people who were, you know, from Europe or from South America, or from like Asia or something like that. We used to live in a town with a art college, so we had a lot of people who just, you know, they're visiting their kids who were in college, and they figured they'd, you know, spend the day or spend the week in town. So you get a lot of different, you know, accents and a lot of different pronunciations of words I find very common, you know, of course. And then I get words that are not common. And I think like one example was somebody's looking for chia seeds and they asked for chai seeds. And, you know, I clarify just like, you know, clarify we're talking about chia seeds, but I was already walking them towards where the chia seeds were because I assumed they knew that chai was a tea and not, you know, maybe a seed, and they just simply mispronounced chia. But it's a sort of thing as like, I can guess that's what you're going for. And this all ties back because it's language, right? It's like, it's just a way to communicate. And sometimes, you know, we miss our point a little bit, because there's still so much miscommunication. But it is, it's all kind of comes down to how well we can communicate and what we try to do to communicate. And that's why it kind of ties back into writing, because obviously writing in, you know, should be in theory a much easier way to communicate, because you have all this time, all this space, and you, there's nothing that is that limiting in the sense of, you know, in language, sometimes it can be limiting if you don't know words and you're not going to like look up, you know, a definition of a word or a thesaurus in the middle of a conversation. Or perhaps you, you know, just simply don't really know how to describe something until it comes to you in the middle of the night and you're like, you know what, that's how you describe it. So I think writing has, you know, sometimes removes limitations of talking. And yet, because there are so many rules of writing, it does get in the way. And some people do, you know, say like, I know my writing's not perfect. And I'm like, yeah, but you've nailed the story. And yes, okay, there are a couple typos or misused words, and inane instead of insane, things like that. But it's still ultimately a very well-written story. And a couple ones I wanted to talk about, because it relates actually into a later series I want to record. And years ago, I started a YouTube channel, and it was one of the things I recorded for it. But there's this subreddit on Reddit called Men Writing Women. And it's sort of just, you know, these examples of men writers writing women characters poorly. And I thought that was really interesting, just to look at, like, almost like as a study, you know, and because it was something that I had come into contact a lot because of being an editor, being a beta reader, and seeing so many people who had never run their story by anyone that, you know, that identifies as a woman and might be a woman and might give them some advice as to how to better, you know, sort of create a character that isn't a caricature or isn't just, you know, insulting. So the first thing that actually I wanted to mention was this idea of fewer versus less. And this is one of those like just steadfast rules, you know, that I mean, so many people are just, you know, if you use the wrong one, everyone just goes apoplectic. And, you know, I have the kind of friends, my father as well, like I mentioned, you know, it's like I'll be in the middle of a conversation and I'm like, you know, he had less than like, and he's like fewer. And I'm like, oh my God, let me just get to the end of the story. I don't care. And that's, I think, a, you know, big one that I grew up with is sort of less than fewer, because I can never really remember. And now it's kind of become one of those things where one just sounds right. And I know there's that rule, obviously, it's the idea that the fewer basically is used when like the number of things is already counted, whereas less is when it's the number is measured, basically. So fewer problems or less time. You don't say fewer time or less problems in theory. But I got really curious about this when I recently read this article or is this something on Reddit, believe it or not, about how this rule originated with one grammarian, one critic, one, you know, not even, I don't necessarily think he was a writer. I think he's just somebody who just a sort of critic of the English language. And I thought it was really fascinating because this guy, Robert Baker, he was, he'd written this sort of usage book anonymously, so we don't actually know who he was. But this person wrote under the name Robert Baker. And they were very clear to explain that they don't have a very firm grasp of Latin, which is important because a lot of English rules do come from the Latin language, which is a little bit strange since it has such heavy Germanic influence as well. And his grasp of ancient Greek was not as strong as it could have been. Again, strange because some of our rules do come from that as well. But he does speak, or he did speak, French and English. And if you've ever tried to learn French, then you'll know that a lot of French words are, or a lot of English words are French words without the French accent, or, you know, basically maybe they're all English words with a French accent, or however you want to say it. But the French words came first, and then we sort of changed our accent and kept the same word. So if you ever do try to learn French, you might find that it's much, much, much easier, not just to learn the language as far as grammar and whatnot, but to guess at the vocabulary. And that's obviously the big part of any language is vocabulary. It's learning what to say and what not to say. Or not necessarily what not to say, but how to say something and how to not say something. And in French, you can, if you know English, you can guess at a lot of French words because they are very, very, very similar. But this rule, this fewer versus less, goes back to one person. And it's not necessarily, it's just simply this person's opinion. It wasn't really based on anything because for years and years and years and years prior, almost, you know, more than 1,000 years since English was even a language, and I'm talking old English, people used less for both, to refer to things that were counted or to things that were measured. So it was already this sort of standard was to use less. And I think fewer did come in here and there for examples, but it was basically one person saying, no. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to start using fewer for this thing, and we're going to use it less for this thing, and they can never be mixed and measured and changed and ever questioned. And this became just the standard. This became the gold standard. And it hasn't changed since then. It's been about 200 years, and it's still, you have, teachers in high school and middle school, basically drilling this into their students that there is one way to speak, which is strange to me because I think like any living language, it's things constantly change, right? It's like there's no setting in stone, a certain part of a language, because things do tend to change over time, whether by usage or whether things are in style or not in style. And I do think that when someone does sit down and tries to set something in stone, you try to sort of, it ends up sort of stagnating a language a bit. It ends up sort of halting a language or stilting a language. And I think that can lead, obviously, to sort of not just a reduction of like creativity necessarily, but it does stifle a sort of a sense of, I mean, I don't know, it's like imagine doing that with art or imagine doing that with dancing or music or anything else. It's like, imagine somebody's like, no, this is how you make music. There's no other way. It's improper to do, whatever it is, this key change, you have to do this key change. Or it's improper to move your body like this, you have to do that. But it's like, then we wouldn't have modern dancing or, I don't know, jazz or anything like that. There's so many of these things come from people breaking this idea of what our current expectations and our current knowledge of, I'm going to say art for an example, but breaking our expectations and knowledge of what art is. And what it can be. And I think that a lot of other fields, a lot of other artistic fields, for lack of a better word, can have these sort of I don't know the plural of that word. And it's kind of okay. It's like, we're not even like okay, it's just it becomes standard. But I think sometimes in writing, because it is used for more than just art, that it's used in a corporate sense, it's used in a business sense, it's used in a communication sense, it's used in a day-to-day sense, so it does become that it's like, it's not necessarily just for art. And of course, that's, you have things like poetry, and that's where that kind of plays in. But the next little rule, I already mentioned, but it's don't end a sentence with a preposition. Again, this is just a sort of a myth, basically, not even a myth necessarily, because I think myth gives it the sort of sense of it is maybe not based on anything, or maybe it's a sort of one rule that kind of got blown out of proportion, but it's something we're still taught. But that, goes back to a 17th century man named John Dryden, and it's, from him that we have this rule. And I kind of, that's the, oops, somebody fucking, whatever. And if you don't know who John Dryden is, you're just like me and I think most other people, but he was just a very, very popular 17th century, restoration, writer. He was, I think, as England's first official poet, laureate. He wrote plays and poems and prose and criticism and, was prolific in his time. I think actually another example of somebody else in that time was John Milton, who I think now could be arguably more well-known than Dryden. But at least at the time, Dryden was more well-known, and not necessarily more liked. Apparently, he was not a very well-liked human being. And he was very opposed to ending a sentence with a preposition. That was his sort of one of his biggest pet peeves, for lack of a better word. He announced that you should never conclude your sentence with a preposition or a conjunction. That's kind of it. And he doesn't ever state why it's not proper or not elegant. I think he uses the term elegant. He never states why it's not elegant. But then somehow, again, it's this sort of, you know, it becomes popular. It becomes the status quo. And so again, this question does come up. It's like, how does one person's opinion become a hard and fast rule in a language, especially at the time that was ever evolving? That was not, you know, I think it was at a time that there are many different ways to spell the same word and many different ways to write the same sentence. And I think, I mean, if you go back even before then to Shakespeare, I think you have Canterbury Tales written around the same time of most of Shakespeare's work. And if you read the two in their original English, they're very different forms of English. And it's like they both, I think, were trying to popularize the form that they were more versed in, for lack of a... I say for lack of a better word, but that's actually a pretty good word. But they you know, they were both, they being... Geoffrey Chaucer and William Shakespeare, were just basically more versed in two different forms of English. They're both trying to popularize and both trying to use their own form of English rather than... you know, combining them, or rather than choosing the other one, or rather than choosing something else. And it's, I mean, which at the time was completely appropriate. But now if you read Canterbury Tales, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to read in its original English. You have to have a translated version, whereas the Shakespeare, original Shakespeare, is not as difficult, is not as impossible, especially if you have some sort of understanding of sort of older English style. The last rule I wanted to talk about in this episode is the rule that you should not split an infinitive. The infinitive version of a infinitive form of a verb is to followed by the verb to run, to jump, to eat, to sleep, etc., etc., etc. So if you have that in a sentence, that's the infinitive form of the verb. And if you speak other languages besides English, then you will know that the infinitive form of the verb is basically before it's conjugated, and you don't. I mean, that's not true. I was going to say you don't often use the infinitive form. You do absolutely use the infinitive form, but it is more commonly seen that you will conjugate this, the infinitive form of a verb, as you do in... romance languages. I believe other languages as well, but my knowledge of romance languages is that you will conjugate the infinitive. And... there's the argument, obviously, that a lot of English rules are based off the Latin rules of language. And in English and in Latin, you could not split the infinitive because the infinitive is one word. So they're saying because you cannot split it in Latin, you should not be able to split it in English. This is a sort of, there's no direct evidence, basically, for this. There's no one that sat down and wrote, this is why we have the rule of not splitting the infinitive. So it's hard to tell if that's the actual truth. But there is another source. And it's a book from 1866 called A Plea for the Queen's English by Henry Alford. And basically, he just has a prejudice, his own prejudice, basically, against splitting an infinitive. He just simply is, again, it's this sort of thing of it does not, you know, the infinitive is should never be separated. Just like in other languages, it cannot physically be separated because it's one word. He finds that in the English language, you should never be able to separate the infinitive, which is difficult because there are a number of examples of sentences. For instance, if you wanted to say something like, here is a tip to safely cut apples, because you have safely cut in between two, or you have safely between two and cut, you've split the infinitive. But it does sound strange when you say, here's a tip to cut apples safely, isn't wrong. It still works, but it's a little bit more clunky. It's a little stranger. There's that famous Star Trek one, to boldly go where no man has gone before. To go boldly where no man has gone before, just, you know, it doesn't work as well. It still works. People still understand it, but it just doesn't work as well. And I think that's kind of what a lot of this comes down to is, one of the things this comes down to is sometimes when you're talking about rules, you have to sort of step aside with what sounds proper, not necessarily what sounds proper, but what is proper as far as grammar. And you have to choose what sounds better and what works better. And sometimes this comes down to the cadence of your story, the rhythm of your story. If you're building momentum, you don't necessarily want to kill the momentum by following grammatical rules. You want to kind of keep this momentum going. And sometimes, you know, if it's like, if you have this sort of staccato scene where you want it to be choppy and hard, then it's another sort of thing. It's like maybe sometimes not splitting the infinitive works versus splitting the infinitive. And that is, you know, it all goes back again to like sort of personal preference, but it does bring up that question of if language is simply here to help us communicate with each other, to help us share information and knowledge work together. Then does it matter too much how we do it, as long as we do it effectively? But the other thing I really want to talk about, and this is what I was going to bring up in the next podcast, or maybe a couple podcast episodes, is this idea of how it's, especially because they're writers, but it's how three different people, in this case specifically, it's Robert Baker, John Dryden, and Henry Alford, basically created these rules, and they're not rules, they were preferences. They were their own preferences based on not much, you know, basically based on just how they like to see things written and how they want to receive letters or how they want to read books. So they wrote down, here's my preferences, and somehow these become, you know, laws or rules. And I think that in one case such as this, it's sort of like ultimately benign, right? It doesn't, using fewer versus less, it doesn't kill somebody to use fewer or less, or ending a sentence with a preposition or splitting an infinitive. But I think there are cases, and I want to bring up the next episode, specifically ones based on the Reddit men writing women. It's this sort of like, how does it happen that one person's stories, you know, one person's novel or book or fable can influence an entire, not just an entire generation, but an entire language, an entire mythology, an entire social group of thinking, social way of thinking. So thank you so much for watching, for listening to this episode. Not watching it, but thank you so much for listening to this episode. And I do hope to get the other one out soon. I'd love everyone's feedback on that. But thank you again for listening, and I hope to see you in the next one.